Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Usually you don't want your dogs getting on your fancy mid-century modern furniture, unless you're Herman Miller and you've teamed up with William Wegman and his Weimaraners.
Both dogs like to be the star and the center of attention, so if you're working with one, you have to work with the other, even though he or she may not be destined for the final work. So I give the other one something important to do as well, and that seems to work well.
It's very Joan Crawford and Bette Davis.
Listen up for a doggy art and style story later. And we'll hear about some oversized plastic containers that are making their way through LA. Before that, though, we're entering the next phase in a hoped-for renewal of Pershing Square. This coming Thursday, new designs for the square will be unveiled to the public at the Palace Theatre on Broadway. They're by four teams that have made the shortlist from dozens of applicants, and they're grappling with some deep-set structural problems at downtown's Pershing Square, like its underground parking structure. Eduardo Santana heads Pershing Square Renew. That's the non-profit charged with advancing the overhaul. We met a few months back at a public outreach event at downtown LA's Farmers Market.
Our mandate from the city, from Councilmember Weezar and the Department of Rec and Parks, is think about all aspects of this, the design, the maintenance, the programming, and help us create a Pershing Square that's going to work over the long term, that can evolve as our downtown evolves, and that could ultimately be that public space that the downtown community really wants.
Pershing Square has gone through many changes. Its most recent was almost 25 years ago when Mexican architect Ricardo Legarreta redesigned the park. At that time, architectural historian Michael Webb wrote a book about city squares. What did he find?
America has not taken to the square in the way that, say, Latin America or Southern Europe has. Robert Venturi...
The American architect.
...was asked to do a square in Washington, D.C., and he said it's ridiculous. Americans don't like just sitting around. They have to be entertained or fed. And Pershing Square, to some degree, suffers from the same problem because people don't want to cross the street and just sit in the square and maybe be panhandled or annoyed by somebody. They'd rather keep walking on the street where they feel safe and where there is something to do and look at. And the square thus becomes rather neglected.
Back to 25 years ago when Ricardo Legarreta redesigned Pershing Square with quite a sort of stark architectural design. You supported the design. Why?
At that time, I was naive enough to think that since Ricardo Legarreta is Mexican, Mexicans, perhaps some of the liveliest squares in the world, that he would bring his magic touch. And at that time, I thought the colorful tar and walls and so on would introduce a kind of vibrant note into what was really a rather gray setting with very meager plantings and frankly nothing much going for it. So this had to be an improvement. My feeling now, looking back on it, looking at it now, is that it was over-designed. It was too much a pretty object and not enough a space that was welcoming and would encourage people to sit out and use it.
That's architectural historian Michael Webb reflecting on Pershing Square's last makeover back in the early 90s. This time around, the process has focused on the public's needs. Before even enlisting design teams, Pershing Square Renew brought in Fred Kent. He is the New York-based founder and president of Project for Public Spaces, which promotes the notion of placemaking. His team did public outreach, which helped shape the program for Pershing Square.
Well, you know, it's a very different time these days. What's happened now is that idea of architecture or design-led is fading fast, and the future is very, very different. It's really about program, about uses and activities, about layering uses on a square, a public space like Pershing Square, that's different from morning to noon to night, even to midnight, and even into the wee hours of the morning, that a place like that can be alive all the time. And it's a very different future than just another park or green space in a city.
But there's a question hanging over the entire process, which is this even a real project? The monies to pay for the renewed park are not yet in place, and the very process of public outreach surrounding the design development is intended to stimulate interest and funds for the project. This is because it is conceived as a public-private partnership with local businesses contributing on the understanding that an enhanced square is better for business. McFarlane Partners and the city gave seed money for the competition. Southwest Airlines gave a grant to support the community outreach, and once a winner is selected, fundraising will start for an estimated $50 million. But do local businesses support this concept? Carol Schatz is president and CEO of the Central City Association of Los Angeles and the Downtown Center Business Improvement District.
You know, $50 million is not chump change. We're, of course, hoping that most of that is public responsibility as opposed to private responsibility, but we'll see what they come up with. That's a lot of money. One of the things that people may not realize is that there is already an assessment district that operates with the park. And for 30 years, the property owners that are immediately around the park pay an assessment every year, and that won't be paid off until 2022. So the private sector has already been providing money for the original redesign of the park and for some of its operations. And I'm sure there will be a willingness for the private sector to participate, but it has to be a reasonable ask.
So do you think the property owners that you represent will look at the schemes and see if any of them really seem, or see if the winning one at least, is kind of viable?
I think they will be very interested. It has a great importance to us downtown, and there will be a lot of attention paid to these designs. I think what we need to understand and hear is, what are the models for that partnership going to be? Who's going to do what? How much is each person's contribution? How is this going to be structured? And until we know those details, it's very hard to say, sign us up.
That's Carol Schatz, longtime head of the Central City Association. So with these considerations in mind, now let's hear from the design teams. They're under a strict embargo and cannot tell us exactly what you'll see Thursday, but they did share with us what they felt were the main challenges and goals. First up, architect Kulapat Yantrasast. He's the founding partner and creative director of Y, that's a studio based in Culver City that has worked on many buildings that house art. He's working with Civitas Landscape Architecture based in Denver.
Well, first and foremost, we want to create a public space that is uniquely LA. We don't want this to look like New York, Chicago, or other places. This has to smell and feel and touch like an LA place.
What does an LA place smell like?
LA smell of diversity. LA smell of taco and kimchi and Thai food and, you know, anything from Eastern Europe to Asia. I think that's what we have, and that's our strength if we choose to look at it. And for me, you know, as an immigrant who came just like you, I chose to come to LA because of the diversity and the strength of it.
Just remind the audience where you came from.
I was born in Thailand and then educated for a long time in Japan.
Sure. So in terms of what we might look to your team to sort of show us on Thursday, what might we expect? Will it be all about the physical design, or will it be about something more intangible?
I think both. LA is a dynamic, ongoing project, and Pershing Square will be the test kitchen that LA get made and unmade daily, meaning that it will be beautiful, but it will be organic and changed by people. But we also want this place to be dynamic, that without people, it functions. It has its own appeal, like what a great public space should be.
That was Kulapat Yantrasast. Next up, James Corner. He's founder and director of James Corner Field Operations, and he's teamed up with architect Fred Fisher and Partners. The two worked together on the design of Tongva Park in Santa Monica. And James Corner is perhaps best known for his landscaping work on the High Line in Manhattan.
I think we're trying to promote a very green, pastoral, simple park with lawns and trees and shade and flowers and greenery, but also a place that has the gravitas of a center. You know, we're right at the center of downtown Los Angeles. So creating a new center that has significance, that is meaningful, that is a place everybody knows as the center point of the city, and is flexible enough to be able to accommodate events and festivals and markets and fairs and be appealing to everybody.
That was James Corner. One of the four finalists in the Pershing Square redesign competition is from a city renowned for its public spaces, Paris. Henri Bava is co-founder and director of Agence Terre. That's a firm of landscape architects, architects and engineers. And they're working with an LA-based landscape design team called SALT.
Today, the Pershing Square, it looks like a walled square. It's a lifted up square. It's not easily accessible. Really, I would like to open it, to make it totally like a livable space for everyone. It's a car-based neighborhood. I would like to develop it as a pedestrian-oriented district.
Do you think that as designer, you have the power to affect the traffic patterns around the park and also to bring the park down lower? Because those seem to be the two big obstacles.
We have the power, if we for sure, if we win the competition to do it. Without, it's not a problem for the car park. You know, in the underground, we need a car park, but the first level of the car park is very high. Today, we could reduce the height of this the last level. We need also much more nature in the city. So that's the second point. For the Californian climate also, we need shade. We could really develop a new canopy. We need more trees for that, shade.
That was Henri Bava with Agence Terre in Paris. One of the really intriguing teams is the partnership of SWA and Morphosis. SWA is a global firm with an LA office whose many projects included landscaping the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Milton Street Park along the banks of Biona Creek. Now, Morphosis is helmed by Tom May, known in LA for the Caltrans building and the Emerson College in Hollywood. Here's Gerdo Aquino, the CEO of SWA.
Tom Main, and he is a very opinionated architect, and him and I, we never get along on anything, but yet we get into these competitions together because we know that the friction will result in something unique and interesting.
But broadly speaking, what might we expect from this interesting, frictive partnership between you and Morphosis?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think people will embrace it, because if people ask themselves the question, you know, do you believe that Los Angeles is the future city of innovation and culture and economy and arts and invention, then look at what we're designing and see if they match. Because I think that's really where I think people will find themselves in deciding, you know, what is the right Pershing Square design. I think it starts with asking ourselves those big questions.
That's Gerdo Aquino from SWA. Now that we've heard from members of all four design teams that are shortlisted in the competition to redesign Pershing Square, let's look at the ideas undergirding these designs, namely what makes public space successful. It turns out that this competition is proving to be a bit of a litmus test for competing philosophies in the world of landscape design. Back to Fred Kent from the Project for Public Spaces.
Well, you have designers who are naturally physical space I don't want to say what I was going to say. I was going to say prima donnas, but isn't quite true. But their whole life is around the physical manifestation of their expertise and art, and they're being asked to do something very different, to be more about the program and about the uses and not about the art design-led award system that is within the discipline. There's a silo of landscape architects, and they all do kind of the same thing. And we have to break out of that because this is a much more complex, much more community-integrated, much more of an innovation center, a hub of activity, than it is a design statement. You know, when we worked on these public spaces early on in New York here, we had tremendous problems with undesirable activity, but by populating with positive activities, we were able to displace that, or not totally replace it, but to displace it to the point where there was a pretty good mix of uses. And that's kind of what the agenda for Pershing Square will become, is one of, you know, let's fine-tune it to the point where it becomes very comfortable for most people, but not an exclusive place for just a few. And that's the very fine line between pretty strong programming and pretty supportive design.
So how do designers of physical space feel about this argument? Back to Gerdo Aquino at SWA.
I think it speaks to kind of where our culture is right now in terms of, you know, do you need 3,000 programs a year happening on 1 acre, or do you want a simple respite, a more Arcadian kind of park with just strolling paths and green open lawn? And I think we're at this really critical point in time where those things are starting to collide. And I think Pershing Square is going to have a very interesting narrative of different ways in which people are looking at that very topic.
Well, just define, if you will, what do we mean by programming?
Things to do. It's activities. It's yoga on the lawn. It's pop-up retail. It's farmers markets on the weekend. It's movie night. It's a foreign language school in a corner of the plaza at 2 p.m. on a Sunday. And it's all of those things. It's all things to do. And again, you think back of turn of the century parks, that wasn't part of their discussion. You know, it wasn't. It was about reinforcing the centrality of the city. And that was it. And the cross path, the axial paths, reinforced that because it was about passing through the center of the city. Their demographics are changing. The millennials are changing everything. I joke around with people here in my office, and I tell them, I said, look, if you don't have a swing or a hammock or a ping pong table in your project, it's not going to go well.
That's Gerdo Aquino of SWA. What do you think Pershing Square should look like and be like? The public is invited to view the final projects from the four finalists on Thursday. You're listening to DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up, despite all the doom and gloom about present-day Pershing Square, it's still an active space. We'll hear about the gigantic plastic containers that started a journey from there. Plus, how do you get a dog to pose on an Eames chair?
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Pop-up art installations usually appear and disappear within days. But there's one installation with a message that is making its way across Los Angeles following its start a few weeks back in Pershing Square. DNA producer Avishai Artsy has the story.
You've seen these objects hundreds of times, thousands. A plastic bottle or a plastic cup with a lid and a green straw, you don't even notice them anymore. So one couple blew them up into giant inflated plastic sculptures, each about the size of a school bus.
I'm Jana Kruder.
And I'm Matthew LaPenta.
And this is Natural Plasticity, and this is an installation that brings into view our monumental impact of disposable plastic.
The artists used post-consumer recycled plastic. The exhibit will move around Los Angeles. LaPenta says the goal is to head west along the LA River, mimicking the journey of plastic trash toward the ocean.
Because that's a huge problem, is that everything's being flushed out to the ocean and we're not really being responsible.
Seeing trash in Pershing Square is hardly unusual, just not at this scale. The area tends to attract litter, and the park hardly feels like being in nature. It's covered in concrete and dwarfed by glittering skyscrapers. But the pieces are big enough to compete with the large purple tower and red balls of Ricardo Lagaretto's 1993 design. Rhonda Mulhern came over to admire the cup and bottle up close.
Well, I can't think of the name of the artist, but it reminded me of, he just does these gigantic, like the Spoon Bridge and Cherry in Minneapolis. You know what I'm talking about?
It's Klaus Oldenburg. Yeah. Definitely big inspiration. I bought her a big Klaus book a few years ago. And
blew my mind. And I was like, I want to do big things. Yeah. So together we did big things.
Jana Kruder says her awareness of disposable plastic began after the couple watched a documentary called Plastic Planet. Later, during hikes through national parks, they'd see plastic trash thrown everywhere. Visual artist Deanna Cohen runs Plastic Pollution Coalition, a global alliance of NGOs and businesses. She came out to the park to see the artwork herself.
Some people have heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Well, we've got multiple garbage patches in all five major oceans in the world. We're not saying that they're islands of plastic. We're saying that the entire ocean has become a plastic soup.
I asked Cohen whether public art like this can actually change people's behavior.
To me, what this does is it's in your face. And the thing about it is we become immune to seeing this stuff. If you drive home tonight, you'll see it along the side of the road. You know, you'll see it everywhere. And people don't even pick it up anymore because there's so much of it.
And the artwork resonates with Eric Garakanyan, who is snapping a selfie in front of the pieces.
I mean, I think it'll make people more conscious of it because it seems all too common to just see like a bottle on the ground and to sort of have that like in such a magnified and large form. I think it might make people, you know, consider that.
On this sunny afternoon, the heat begins to take a toll on the art.
We're putting more air in the straw. It deflates sometimes, so we're going to put more air in and make it stand upright.
Natural plasticity will next be displayed in Los Angeles at Griffith Park this Saturday and Elysian Park this Sunday. For DNA, I'm Avishai Artsy.
Now, what do you get if you combine Weimaraner's and sleek mid-century modern furniture? Well, you get a very stylish dog story.
And how did the dog get into the videotaping?
I was doing floor pieces, things like that, and he was just a total pest, an impossible dog. And uh-huh. I'd be taping something on the floor, and there he was. But he looked great. He looked a lot better than the bits of cheese or nails or whatever it was I was conceptually placing in the corner.
Yeah.
And he was gray, and that seemed to suit black and white video very well.
That's William Wegman, the artist, back in 1982, telling David Letterman about his early experimental films involving his Weimaraner dog, Man Ray. Since then, the one-time California-based artist has become famous for his photographs of his dogs posing on chairs, in funny hats, or wearing people's clothing. Now Wegman has a new show at Mark Selwyn Fine Art in Beverly Hills. It's called New and Used Furniture 1972 to 2015, and it features photos from the early days of his career when the chairs were anonymous to today's pictures featuring furniture as iconic as his royal hunting dog models. The Weimaraners pose on Eames chairs, benches and stools that were loaned by the furniture company Herman Miller with an assist from Michael Reynolds. Reynolds is US editor at Wallpaper Magazine, and he had invited Wegman to guest edit an issue of the Star magazine. The dogs also adorn chairs and benches by designer George Nakashima that were loaned by an auction house in Paris. We met up with William Wegman along with Mark Selwyn and Michael Reynolds, and I asked Bill Wegman to introduce his top models.
These are my dogs, Flo and her younger brother, half-brother, Topper. And they're Weimaraners, about 4 and 3 years old. I'm used to putting my dogs on stools or pedestals or anything to keep them occupied and busy and happy because they like being up on things.
There's a sort of smooth finish perfection to these images. They almost remind you of 17th century paintings of an English aristocrat's dog, you know. But presumably, there's a lot of chaos along the way. Is there, described to us, a shoot involving Flo and Topper?
Well, both dogs like to be the star and the center of attention. So if you're working with one, you have to work with the other, even though he or she may not be destined for the final work. So otherwise, you get them jumping each other. They try to assault each other or knock the other one off the set. So I give the other one something important to do as well. Kind of parallel play, and that seems to work well.
It's very Joan Crawford and Bette Davis, in a way, on set with the two of the dogs. And I was really thinking about it. The dogs are so incredibly graphic. I mean, they're short-haired, beautiful lines to their bodies, very athletic. Their fur has this beautiful sheen, and it really is, in a similar way, like these mid-century pieces that are all about line, shape, curve. And the dogs actually complement that quality in the furniture and vice versa.
So, Mark, I have a quick question for you. What makes these images very much art and not sisters and brothers of the rather beautiful imagery that we're seeing in advertising that incorporates animals?
Well, two things. One is I look at the yellow chair and the Eames chair, and I think of almost a shape out of an Ellsworth Kelly painting. But the other part of it is that they really come out of Bill's early work in performance and video, where the dogs were performers in these photographs and in these videos, and they're still performers. It is a performance, and it's a document of a performance. And Bill was one of the pioneers of California conceptual art, along with John Baldessari, who he shared a studio with. John Baldessari inherited Bill's studio when Bill unfortunately left us to move to New York.
Did you feel that in any way it might be sort of tipping into advertising?
Well, I don't think that's an awful thing. It's just, you know, the whole world of pictures and images, it really gets quite blurred. If it's advertising, it sort of gets twisted. But some beautiful images have been used in advertising, and even the Mona Lisa, for God's sakes. You know, it's been captured before. These, I don't really see them as advertising. I see them as Wegmans that happened last year.
Do you offer them a reward for all of this?
Not while we're working. I don't use food. I don't like lurch and drool. I like, I might go somewhere and make believe I'm leaving and to get a certain look, or I'll hide behind something, or I'll say a word. And language just empties out. If you say, like, my dogs used to be really excited about cats, but if you say, "Here's a cat," 20 times, they go, "There's no cat." But I never use food unless when I'm making a film or a movie, I need them to look like they're reading a book. I will and have before smeared a book with cheese. And it's pretty disgusting, but it keeps their attention.
And lastly, you know the magazines Cat Fancy and Dog Fancy, and they're now they are now rebranded for the Instagram age, and they're now called Catster and Dogster. I have this sneaking suspicion that your work has been a bit of an inspiration, and that there's quite a few people out there trying to sort of do a Wegman with their poodles, you know, or their do you relish the thought of having inspired a million Instagram images?
I don't dare say that I don't. Because they're formidable, and I'm afraid of dog people, for sure, because they are so fierce and lovely at the same time. It's both a blessing and a curse, you know, to get bombarded with these totally charming and silly and ridiculous things, and I do get to see zillions of them, and I have a personal collection of lots of them.
I mean, last night at dinner, everybody was shoving their iPhones in Bill's face while he was trying to eat Chinese food. With their dog pictures on it.
That's so fascinating. So you have opened a door for people.
Well, apparently, since I am the dog guy, so come and get me.
That was William Wegman. His new show is at Mark Selwyn Fine Art in Beverly Hills. It's called New and Used Furniture, 1972 to 2015. You can also see images of his dogs on Herman Miller chairs at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by JC Swatek. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.